Lawrence Power playing Richard Rodney Bennett's music, written for Lady Caroline Lamb, arranged by Bennett as an elegy for viola and orchestra. The score originally for Robert Bolt's 1972 film, telling of the love affair between Caroline Lamb, wife of William Lamb, Lord Melbourne, and the poet Byron 200 years ago. Richard Chamberlain played Byron in the film. Sarah Miles was Lady Caroline. Lawrence Power, one of the great stars of the viola, he returns to the platform now. Regular on the Prom stage, concert halls around the world. Recently been playing Berlioz's Harold in Italy, in Chicago, Bartok Concerto for our Concertgebouw Orchestra in Amsterdam, Miklos Rocha's concerto with the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, and Penderecki's concerto with Camerata Salzburg. Back on the stage now, Lockhart. Next is going to speak to the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Proms. That was the elegy for viola and orchestra from the movie Lady Caroline Lamb, music composed by Richard Rodney Bennett, who died this past December at the age of 76. Richard was an incredibly versatile musician. He scored over 50 films, perhaps most famously among them, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Murder on the Orient Express, for which he garnered one of his three Academy Award Best Score nominations in 1974. Though he spent most of his career living in New York, he was a great friend of this particular orchestra, and a few years ago, for his 70th birthday, there was a special concert arranged by the concert orchestra for him. We will miss him and his great music making. This morning's, it's jet lag. The first part of tonight's concert is dedicated to British war films. And those films, especially those that were actually made during wartime, were of course much more than mere entertainment. They were also propaganda in the best sense of the word. They were put out there to raise people's spirits, to engender patriotism, and to bring comfort to people in times of hardship and actual danger. We've gone through quite a few of those scores, and we're going to go on to the Warsaw Concerto, one of the pieces from these films that has made a comfortable home on the concert stage as well, with Valentina Lisitsa later in the program. But first, another inspiring march for you. This is the march from the movie, the 1958 war movie, Ice Cold in Alex. Now, those of you who aren't film buffs may wonder, well, what's wrong with Alex? The answer is very simple. Alex is Alexandria, and the stars of the film have to get through Rommel's lines and go to the city of Alexandria, where waits for them an ice-cold beer, something that I could personally use right now. The march from Ice Cold in Alex. Thank you.
The march from Ice Cold in Alex. Leighton Lucas provided the score. A tale of two British officers escorting an ambulance to Alexandria. En route, they pick up a South African officer who is not all he seems. John Mills starred as Captain Anson, Anthony Quayle as Van der Perl, the South African who was actually German, and Sylvia Sims played Sister Diana Murdoch. Well, Radio 3 live at the Proms this Saturday with the BBC Concert Orchestra. Next, a piano to be moved centre stage for one of the shortest concertos in the repertoire, Richard Adensel's Warsaw Concerto, used in the wartime melodrama Dangerous Moonlight. This was the tale of a Polish airman who also happened to be a concert pianist. The film's plot hatched by three members of British military intelligence, writer Terence Young, musician Lionel Salter, and actor Basil Bartlett. Young soon realised that a mini concerto winding its way right through the film would help tie the plot together, and with the right piece, ensure that the audience left cinemas humming away to themselves. Well, the story goes that the team approached Rachmaninoff first of all, then Misha Spolyansky, the Russian-born, London-based composer, but both of them said no. So they went to Adensel, who created a work that was an immediate success. It's been recorded more than 100 times. It sold millions of copies. Its length, by the way, to ensure that it fitted neatly onto a 78 RPM disc. Well, tonight, the concerto will be played by the Ukrainian-American pianist Valentina Lisitsa.
When I was approached to play this piece, of course, I heard all about it from my friends. You would not believe how many times they would tell me, oh, you've got to play this piece, this is just like Rachmaninoff. And, you know, when somebody says something is just like something else, you know, like Rachmaninoff or, you know, anything else, you immediately get yourself into defensive position. Like, why would they play something like Rachmaninoff when, in fact, I have a real thing? And when I started learning piece, you know, when, of course, when I was approached to do it for BBC, I was terribly excited, and I wouldn't say no just because it sounds like Rachmaninoff. But actually, this mindset doesn't make justice for this piece, because no, it's not Rachmaninoff, it's not Chopin, it's not Gershwin, it's the music in itself. And of course, movie music, it's very interesting always to play, because music is, in a way, it's abstract, but yet we do see programs, we imagine program notes for music. You know, we know something that's happening here, and here we have movie and music written for the script of movie. Of course, when you watch this movie and you see the moments when music is played, it's so natural, it's a part of it. It's a part of a script, so it's very difficult to separate. Of course, you know, you're thinking about everything, and you try also to generalize in a way, not to follow script necessarily, you know, all the turns and speech and dialogues, but just playing music. For me, it's great because I'm a visual person, you know, I'm imagine things. But, you know, so was Franz Liszt, you know, he was writing programs for his works, he was writing programs for other people's works, and it worked for audience wonderfully. So I'm like really, really looking forward to playing this piece, and not only tonight, but many times after.
Valentina Lisitsa speaking earlier on today, and Cynthia Fleming, leader of the BBC Concert Orchestra, about to play the A for the orchestra to tune. Interestingly, Valentina Lisitsa is familiar with the film Battle of Britain. She says that it was thanks to her mother, who grew up steeped in the movies of this era. There was a short time when they were made available in the Soviet Union, when there was a period of warmer relations between the Allies after the war. I grew up hearing them, she says, incessantly praised, so in a way it's an interesting challenge for me to perform and hear the music that my mother adores. Not surprisingly, she is a great fan of the film scores of Shostakovich and Prokofiev. Prokofiev's Alexander Nevsky, she reckons, is probably the best. Well, Warsaw Concerto, part of a film, Dangerous Moonlight, that was a huge success. It was made by the prolific Irish filmmaker Brian Desmond Hirst. He was the director. Cecil Beaton made the costumes. And running right the way through the film, Richard Adensel's Piano Concerto, that soon found a life for itself on the radio and in concert programmes, as we find it tonight here in this film music prom, Valentina Lisitsa, joining Keith Lockhart and the BBC Concert Orchestra, Richard Adensel's Warsaw Concerto in the 1941 film Dangerous Moonlight. Valentina Lasitsa playing Richard Adensel's Warsaw Concerto. Keith Lockhart conducting the BBC Concert Orchestra. Work written for the 1941 film Dangerous Moonlight. Adensel had a particularly busy war. He'd just come back from Hollywood, where he'd gone to work rather unsuccessfully at the RKO studios. Came back to score films including Gaslight, Love on the Dole, This England and The Big Blockade, as well as some 20 wartime documentaries for the Ministry of Information. When he was leaving one of Mara Hesse's wartime concerts at the National Gallery, that on the steps he met Joyce Grenfell, went on to form a great partnership with her, writing numerous songs for her one-woman shows. Adensel continued scoring movies for most of the rest of his life. He died in 1977. Valentina Lasitsa now returns on her own, wearing a duck egg blue chiffon dress. Bows by the piano. Ukrainian-born pianist, raised in Kiev, her mother a seamstress, sent her to music college in the hope that she would become a piano teacher, a safe job. She's become one of the great stars of the contemporary classical world after launching her YouTube channel with more than 50 million viewers, where she introduces her fans to films of her performing and rehearsing. Well, it's coming up to 8:30. Welcome if you've just joined us. Radio 3 live at the Proms this Saturday. Still to come, music by Richard Strauss, Johann Strauss Jr. and Ligeti, as used in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. We'll hear David Arnold, the British composer, revitalizing the grandiose Hollywood sound of yesteryear, and music by John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith. But during the interval, it's time for Proms Plus, recorded a little earlier this evening, over the road at the Royal College of Music. We join Matthew Sweeten guests as they explore the challenges of creating the sound of space for film.
In the past few decades, we've been sending probes deeper and deeper into space. We've drawn attention to ourselves. And if the aliens are now watching crackly TV broadcasts of our old science fiction films, we've got a bit of explaining to do. Musically, I mean. Why, oh, why, oh, why, they're probably saying on Alpha Centauri, do these humans always start playing the theremin when we come on? That's one of the deep, deep space questions we'll address with our guests as tonight's film music prom beams itself into the repertoire associated with and written for science fiction cinema. So let me introduce you to the leaders of the away team who will play Kirk and Spock to my man in a red jumper who's the first to get killed. They are the composers Miguel Mera and Anna Meredith. Now, in space, no one can hear you scream, no one can hear you do anything, pretty much, I think, and no composer has ever been sent into space. So what musical ideas does it suggest to you, Miguel?
I think there have been two main ideas that I think composers have tended to use when it comes to scoring or representing space. One, I think, is about the music of the future at a particular time, whatever that might be, with whatever technological advancements there are at the time. The other, though, is also music of the past. And in lots of films about space, there's use of pre-existing music, very literally music of the past, or sort of harking back to romantic music in some kind of way to sort of keep it grounded somehow in sort of earthly reality or something like that.
Earth always does seem to be present, doesn't it, musically, when we go into space, Anna? Sometimes it attempts to be descriptive, doesn't it? We get those little kind of twinkly piccolos, don't we, in John Williams's Star Wars music. But is space really a void that a composer can fill with any sound that she prefers?
I think you can. I think space can be the platform for almost any film in a way. I mean, I think quite often, increasingly, we're seeing situations where I think it's maybe a film that just happens to be in space, or it could be that space is giving the right atmosphere, isolation or loneliness. So I think we can use it as a tool to give something really special musically if we want to.
But does a piece have to have certain qualities to reflect the atmosphere, if I can put it like that, of space? Is there something that you can, you know, can hear a piece of music and say that says something of the world beyond ours?
I think there's definitely cliches of space, the theremin, this electronic instrument, which we associate with 1970s wobbly aliens. And increasingly, listening to more contemporary space music, either we have these epic, big, wow, look at the size of that spaceship sounds, or we can have these more isolated soundtracks, which are very thin and very singular lines, which maybe give something more of the isolated side of space, which is nice to explore.
And what's your approach to this theme, Miguel, professionally? When you, you know, if you were given the brief for something in space, what kind of ideas do you think you would find yourself using?
It very much depends on the film. I mean, I think, as Anna's just said, some films are set in space, but they're not really about space. I mean, a classic example is Star Wars, which I think, you know, yes, it's set in space, but really it's a fairy tale. It's about good and evil. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons that the score kind of harkens back to that sort of romantic kind of sound. So it really depends on the context of the film. I mean, I think what it gives composers is an excellent opportunity to try and do something new. So I would hope in a sci-fi film, in a space film, there'd be that kind of opportunity. But it really depends on what kind of film it is. There have been so many approaches.
Okay, well, let's listen now to a couple of extracts from the soundtracks of two very famous films set in space. Two journeys into space there. The first from the 1956 film Forbidden Planet, scored by Louis and B. Baron, followed by Johann Strauss's The Blue Danube, used in 1968 to accompany the wheeling space stations of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, which actually most of the audience here were replicating the movements of as the music played here. Miguel, for many listeners, that Strauss waltz now means spaceships, doesn't it? But 44 years ago, I imagine there was a kind of radicalism to this.
Absolutely, yeah. It's an extremely radical sort of decision to sort of use that music. I mean, it's the last thing you would think of. Not now, of course, but then. It was really, really sort of striking. And I think it just contradicts all of ideas that we've had about space before that, about technological advancement and so on. It brings it back to a sort of 19th century grace and elegance and dancing and sort of rotation. It's a wonderful sort of combination. I think something very interesting about film music is that when you see combination of music and images, you don't sort of think, well, that's wrong. You try and find the connections. And I think that's what's wonderful about this music. It has its own context, and the film has its own context, and you put them together and it creates something completely new.
What does it create for you, Anna, that strange conjunction of sound and image in that film?
I think it's something amazing when you see something very familiar. Even if you somehow didn't know that piece of music, you can pick up the rhythm and the sort of feel of it, and it feels very familiar. So I think there's something very powerful about the juxtaposition of something so safe with something so literally alien. You know, I think there's that. That putting the familiar in an unfamiliar place is a very powerful tool.
It says something, doesn't it, about the banality of life in space, doesn't it? Because we are introduced to this is our first moment in the 21st century, isn't it? And these space stations are wheeling around. They move so gracefully. But inside, it's like an airport departure lounge, and there's Leonard Rossiter, isn't it, and his friends who have just come back from doing some shopping. It says something about the strange triviality of space life, too.
I think we're always very... I think quite often when you ask people about about their favourite bits in space films. Quite often people are always intrigued by the details. Where do they go to the toilet? You know, it's that kind of thing. I think there's sometimes a real, you know, the space food or the space transport. I think we like to know how our daily lives transpose into in that situation.
We've got that Viennese flavour there. But I wonder whether in earlier science fiction films, other traditions weren't favoured. There seems to me to be a lot of Russian music in science fiction films of the 30s, 40s and 50s. There's a lot of Borodin in a film called Fire Maidens from Outer Space, where Harry Fowler goes to Venus. And there's quite a bit of Tchaikovsky in the Flash Gordon serials from the 30s. I wonder whether Russia meant something in this context too.
I suppose, I mean, you can argue that, and I think there would be a case for it, certainly in the 1950s sci-fis, because a lot of those really are about the Cold War. You know, it's a threat of alien other, you know, an alien invasion. And there's, you know, a nuclear sort of holocaust is one of the themes of a lot of those films. So certainly there's that case. I think the other thing is that a lot of the classic sort of Hollywood film music of the 30s, 40s onwards is all created by European emigres. You know, some Germanic, some sort of Russian, Dmitry Chomkin, for example, very well-known Hollywood film composer. So some of that language, I'm sure, is transposed across, not just in sci-fi, I think in sort of film music of that era more generally.
So there were aliens writing it, as well as writing it for being up there on the screen. So should film music for science fiction, at its best, is it sourced from the past? Or does it try and give a sense of what the future might be, Anna?
I think it, again, depends on the film.
But give us an example of it working well, then, in either case. We've got Kubrick's use of classical music. You know, what are the scores, what are the more electronic scores, the more kind of forward-looking scores that appeal to you?
I love things like the Alien soundtrack, or even Kubrick's use of the Ligeti side of the music, which Ligeti didn't know about, which I find really amazing.
Well, tell us about that.
So the composer Ligeti's music is used right through 2001, which he didn't know about, and when he came to the cinema, that's for the first time he heard it. It must have been an eye-opener. So I think he then negotiated that rather than having a settlement, that he would be used in future Kubrick films. So that was a nice relationship, which has gone into lots of future films. But it gives an unbelievably... Ligeti's music is so complicated and otherworldly. I mean, you can see why it would have appealed, and it's very hard to find your way through the threads of what he's writing to grab on something, and it's very unnerving. So you can totally see the appeal of why he would have liked, why he would have been drawn to this music.
We've heard something already of the soundscape of Forbidden Planet. Now, that seems to me to be a good place to go if we're going to try and excavate, in a way, what these films are really about, and that's the moment in which they're made, I suppose. Miguel, tell us about the sound world of Forbidden Planet.
So you mentioned it was a husband and wife team, Louis and Bebe Baron, that composed that in 1956, and they were experimenting with music technology. So they were working with oscillators and circuits and so on. They were working in New York. They did a bit of work with John Cage, and they sweet-talked a producer into sort of letting them do the music for this film, Forbidden Planet.
So they're using electronic devices then that would have been, I mean, not designed for making music.
No, they literally made their own circuits, which they amplified, and they would sort of send them into their own kind of loop. So these circuits would sort of all interact with each other and eventually overload and blow up and die, and they would record all of that sound. In fact, one of the really iconic moments from the film Forbidden Planet is the sound of one of the circuits dying. It's literally overloading and exploding.
The film is set on a planet where a spaceship lands. It's a version of The Tempest, isn't it? And a mission comes to find out what's happened to this expedition. And there is a sort of alien world of the planet, isn't there? But there's also the human technological world, the laboratory of Morbius, who is the Prospero character. What we hear when we go down into his laboratory is incredibly strange and discordant, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And one of the things about the music for this film is that no one called it music. And if you look at the opening titles for it, it doesn't say original music or electronic music. It says electronic tonalities. And the studio were worried that the musicians' union might have some issue with the idea that this music was created without using real performers. So I think there's a sense of no one, it was really new, no one really knew even what to call it or whether it was music.
How does it sound to our ears now, Anna? Because in 1956 it was meant to express something of the future. Does it still do that, even though now it has a kind of historical vibe to it, because we associate it with this analogue way of making music?
I think now, to us, it sounds like a dated idea of what the future was meant to sound like. I mean, I think you almost, there's almost like a parody. It's impossible to hear some of these sounds now, even in concert music written of the time, without being able to date them back to the 60s and 70s. And it, you know, and that's made a feature of in films like Mars Attacks. You have, you know, the these sounds are almost impossible to removed from the idea of sort of space cliche now, and so I think you'd have to be very careful how you use them today to hint the future. I think in a way it has almost says more about the past than the future now.
Had electronic music colonized space by the 50s and 60s? I mean, Anna mentioned the theremin, which is, you know, tell us about the theremin, Miguel, because this seems to me to be the key instrument, science fiction instrument of this period.
Yes, it became used a lot in sort of 50s sci-fi. I think its most prominent first use in a sci-fi film is a Bernard Herrmann score for The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is 1951-ish, I think.
And what is a theremin?
So it's an electronic instrument, and it's actually the result of... It was made by a Russian, Leon Theremin in the West, he was known. And it was a result of a government experiment into proximity sensors. So you have sort of two antennae, and they create a sort of electromagnetic field around them. And as you move your hand into the electromagnetic field, one controls pitch and the other controls volume. So if you see someone playing it, they look a bit like a puppet. They're doing this kind of movement. And
what does it sound like? Can we do an impression?
It's a pure sine wave, theoretically. So it sounds sort of kind of noise. Was that all right?
Yes. It was great.
There
you are, yes. Go on. Let's have a round of applause.
Thank you. Yeah. If you know the Beach Boys song Good Vibrations, it's a theremin in that. That's the weird sort of noise in that. And it became, you know, absolutely a cliche for the alien other, as it was used in that Bernard Herrmann score. Curiously, though, that it's not the first use of the theremin. It was used throughout the 1940s, most famously in Miklos Roze's score for Spellbound, where it's really associated then with psychological... And it's associated with psychological trauma. So actually Herrmann's use of it sort of started this 1950s trend of representing aliens through this kind of instrument.
OK, well, I want to talk now about a film that combines both of these approaches, the music of the past and a music that tries to grasp the coming future. Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, which was the Soviet answer to 2001, A Space Odyssey, which combines hardcore electronic sound with this. Eduard Artemyev's theme for Solaris, his version of Bach's choral prelude in F minor. For me, this is one of the most hauntingly strange sounds in science fiction cinema. The soundtrack that somehow conveys this idea of characters who are trapped on this spaceship, a long, long way from the Earth and yearning for it.
Yes, I think that's one of the functions of this Bach reworked on the film, is it's a kind of a nostalgia for Earth. But it's contrasted with Eduard Artemyev's score, which is, you know, a synthesized kind of score. And in fact, towards the end of the film, that Bach is sort of degraded or destroyed by that sort of synthesized score. So there's a kind of merging of those two worlds. And this relates very closely to the story of the central protagonist, who is having hallucinations and we don't know what's real. It's very much a dream kind of scape, the way this film is presented to us.
I wonder why fragments of old music like that, embedded in science fiction, are so powerful. Artemyev, when he was writing that, said he wanted to make the orchestra function like a giant synthesizer. Perhaps he is doing that. But what happens when we listen to something like that in that context? Why is it so powerful to hear something from the earth in space?
Because I think, again, it's that same juxtaposition of familiar and unfamiliar. I think it's the same almost thing as those details of transport and food. I think it gives us something to latch onto and humanizes something which we can only imagine in other ways. So I think it's very much just about giving a bit of heart or a bit of humanity to a place that otherwise the music might be going to remove us from the humanity and our current relationship with it.
Or a sense of distance too, perhaps, distance from the earth.
Yes, absolutely. And I think also, I mean, it's significant that it's Bach, you know, and there's a whole religious context to this music. There's a sense of transcendence through this music. And I think that's a really important part of it. I mean, you can think of other pieces of music, but that immediately that use of Bach sort of gets a deeper sort of layer there.
And actually Bach also is so, it's very clean music. I think if that had been a romantic piece of music, I think there'd be a different, if it had been quite manipulative or a big swelling chord, I think in a way it's more emotional because it's quite private music, it's quite contained, and I think it makes you come towards it rather than coming to you, which I think is quite a nice thing to do as a viewer and listener.
What you're describing there, that more romantic approach, that perhaps more manipulative approach, has become the orthodox with science fiction films, hasn't it? I suppose since John Williams's score for Star Wars in 1977, a big, grand, you know, bells and whistles, orchestral score. Star Wars is quite a nostalgic film, isn't it? It's rather like a 1930s Saturday morning serial made on a vast scale. Perhaps the music is backward-looking in the same way.
Yeah, I think absolutely Star Wars was backward-looking and unashamedly so. I mean, that's also a reaction to all of this electronic music of the 50s and 60s, and it's harking back to a 1930s classical Hollywood sound, absolutely. But I think that's because of the nature of that film. I mean, I don't think every film sort of after Star Wars has attempted to do it in that way. The influence of it is there in certain kinds of Hollywood films about space and about science fiction.
But there is a profound pleasure to be had, isn't there, from that big John Williams sound? I think we mustn't underestimate it.
No, absolutely. And, you know, Star Wars is a great film in so many ways. But as I say, I think it's a fairy tale, and that's what's enjoyable about it. The space part of it is only, you know, a small part of what the narrative is really about, which is about this epic struggle between good and evil. You know, there's a war going on here, and there's even a princess and there's a knight. You know, it's a fairy tale in essence.
And that's where we have to open the pod bay doors and expel ourselves into the vastness of space, where the great domed mothership is waiting to pick us up. Before that happens, let's thank our guests, Anna Meredith and Miguel Mera. Live long and prosper.
Matthew Sweet presenting tonight's Proms Plus. The producer was Philippa Ritchie. And this is Petroc Trelawney with you on Radio 3, live at the Royal Albert Hall, celebrating film music. We'll be continuing those celebrations from mid-September here on Radio 3. And across the BBC, a major BBC focus on film music, including a three-part series presented by the composer Neil Brand, looking at the music that made the movies. Featuring directors ranging from Tarantino to Scorsese. That's on BBC Four. Big names from cinema introduced there. Favourite film music on Six Music. Bollywood on the BBC Asian Network. And on Radio 3, programmes including Composer of the Week, looking at British film music and Hollywood composers. Nightwaves, broadcasting from the British Film Institute. And Saturday Classics, featuring actors and directors and performers, including two icons of cinema, Terence Stamp and Sir Tom Courtney. Lots of concerts as well given by the BBC performing groups, including the BBC Concert Orchestra, celebrating some of the great film music scores from Britain, America, and around the world. The BBC's film music season starting in mid-September. Full details at the Radio 3 website. Well, tonight, our film music evening continues with music from both sides of the Atlantic, David Arnold, John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith ahead, and we bring you bang up to date with part of Michael Giacchino's score to the latest Star Trek epic, Into Darkness. We begin with a trio of great European composers whose work was made full use of by Stanley Kubrick in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Here lies one of those great Hollywood fables. Kubrick had previously worked with the composer Alex North on Spartacus in 1960. He was urged by MGM to book him again, and so he did. But Kubrick was becoming increasingly angry at the studio boss's interference in his projects. Though Alex North went ahead and scored the film, from the beginning, Kubrick never planned to use any of his music. He'd already worked out the classical selections that he wanted to use instead. Poor North, when he turned up at the New York premiere of the film in 1968, he only then discovered that not a bar of his work had been used. Neither Kubrick nor anyone else had even bothered to tell him. Ironically, George Ligeti, one of the chosen composers, was furious that his music had been used without his permission. Well, to add insult to injury, Alex North had even gone as far as writing a score that imitated the masterworks that Kubrick wanted to use, including the opening to Richard Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra, Ligeti's Atmospheres, and Johann Strauss II's Waltz by the Blue Danube, extracts from which we are going to hear as we begin part two of our film music prom. Keith Lockhart, principal conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra, returns to the stage. Music from 2001, A Space Odyssey, filmed by Stanley Kubrick, starting with Richard Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra. Heart of Strauss's by the beautiful Blue Danube, before it, Atmospheres by Judge Ligeti, and the opening of Also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, as used by Stanley Kubrick in the soundtrack to 2001, A Space Odyssey. Keith Lockhart's going to speak now once again.
A selection of classical music that's associated with Stanley Kubrick's great space epic, 2001, A Space Odyssey, the film that really launched the craze for space fantasy films that, well, continues to the current day. Stanley Kubrick originally commissioned Alex North to write a complete original score for 2001, but when he put it against the film, well, he hated it. He got rid of it and went back to the music that he had used to dummy in as he was making the film, which was all original classical material, and thus forevermore, Blue Danube Waltz will be associated with astronauts in the void on a spacewalk, and the fanfare, that incredible stirring fanfare with which we began this portion of the program, will be always called the 2001 fanfare, as opposed to Also Sprach Zarathustra. The important question of the evening remains this. Are there any Trekkies out there? That's all? Live long and prosper. Well, then you will be very excited to know that tonight the concert orchestra presents the world premiere of the suite from Michael Giacchino's score to the new film, Star Trek Into Darkness. Hope you enjoy it.